Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Head to Safeway this week for these amazing deals for members. Mix and match 1 pound strawberries or 6 ounce blueberries, raspberries, or blackberries for $2.99 each when you buy three. Take advantage of this exclusive digital deal. USDA Choice Boneless Beef Tri-Tip Roast, Untrimmed Twin Pack, $3.97 per pound, limit one package. Visit Safeway.com for more details. See you in the aisles.
.9 27, we like to talk about mental health every other Tuesday here because we know it's very important. And we're joined now by Dr. Judy Ho, PhD, ABPP, ABPDN. Well, we're all grown up, so we don't have to spell it. How you doing, Dr. Judy?
Hi, Tommy. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, thank you. Clinical forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast, author of several books, Stop Self-Sabotage, The New Rules of Attachment. You can get those at the usual outlets. Dr. Judy, we were going to talk about New Year's resolutions, and we will, but I don't think we've spoken to you since the New Year started. And, of course, you know what happened on Bourbon Street. You lived here for a while. You're familiar with the area. What would you advise, or how would you advise people to deal with this? Maybe they weren't directly affected, but what can the area expect, I guess, maybe would be a better way to put it?
Yeah, you know, I think that it's obviously really difficult because essentially the whole community has been through a community-wide trauma. Everyone's response to it is going to be different, but you know, one thing that, you know, part of the reason why I was in your neighborhood for a couple of years while I was a postdoc was that we were working with the Hurricane Katrina aftermath. And I remember working with the local mental health providers, and they themselves were having PTSD symptoms while they were trying to help their clients who had similar responses. And so it can be challenging because you're leaning on people in your community, which is what we all should do, but everybody's been through that trauma as well. And so I think that it's a tough part of it, but it's also what can be comforting because you know the person that you're talking to really knows what you're talking about, and they're empathizing from a shared experience standpoint as well, you know, as opposed to just saying, well, yeah, I think I might understand what that's like. But they don't really know, you know. So some pros and some cons with that. But I think overall, we have to just lean in with the people that we trust most and have the conversations to try to process through it at the pace that you're most comfortable with.
What are some of the things that collectively, maybe as the community, we might be feeling individually, but as it relates to something like this, that we're likely to feel?
I think that, you know, there's a couple of the things that are the most common is many of the stages of grief. And so, again, people go through those stages in different ways. I don't think it's linear, but there are people who are going to be very angry. They're looking for who to blame and who to try to, you know, prosecute because of what happened. And then there are people who are going to be sinking into an existential crisis of sorts and become really depressed. There are people who are going to be bargaining, especially if they've lost somebody. It's like they're in disbelief, and it's like they're still trying to get that person back, even though they're not here anymore. Or maybe that person is a healthy person back if they've been one of the injured people. And then even just, you know, this feeling of denial, just complete denial that anything has happened. And there are some people who respond in that way because it's protective. Like, well, nothing's happened. I don't have to take any more precautions. I don't have to think about this neighborhood in any different ways. I'm just going to keep living my life. And of course, some of that is adaptive, but to a degree, it may not be, especially if you're putting yourself in harm's way.
Dr. Judy, I got to apologize to you because I got a lot of things zooming across the desk throughout the 4 hours and a couple of texts pop up. Is Dr. Judy safe in California? Give Dr. Judy my love. I didn't even ask about you and the fires in California, and I am so sorry about that. How are you? And I was focused on Bourbon Street and everything I'm doing here this morning. I didn't even think about asking you about that. How are you and your family and the area dealing with the fires?
Well, thank you so much for asking. We are fine in terms of where I live, but I have many friends and colleagues who've had to evacuate, and actually some who have completely lost their homes. So definitely very heavy feeling in our community right now. And similar to what I was mentioning to you, we have a mixture of responses as well to this tragedy. And there are people who are looking for someone to blame and to point the finger at, and that's making them feel productive. Other people who are still in denial about losing their homes. There are people who are really just, you know, still bargaining, like, well, maybe we haven't lost everything. Actually, one of my neighbors who just moved in across the street, you know, they just rented the place across the street. They said that their house in the Palisades completely burned down. And then her husband has been just kind of going by their place, like driving by the last couple of days, like just seeing if there's anything to salvage. I mean, so it's just, it's very sad, but it's also a completely understandable reaction that he's like, well, maybe there's something that hasn't burnt up and I can still recover it.
Can you, Dr. Judy, where you live, are you smelling this? Are you seeing this, the smoke all the time? Is that, I'm just trying to get a feel.
Yes. Yeah, we have a lot of ash. I mean, this is, it sounds ridiculous to even say that that's a problem, but yes, we have a lot of ash all over our yard and at our front door. We just kind of sweep it every couple of days. I mean, it's insane only because the nearest fire is about maybe 10 miles away from us. Mm-hmm. And we're still getting the ash blown. The, you know, air quality is impacted. So we've not been going outside on most days and staying inside and turning off all of our HVACs and things like that. But, you know, one of the worst fires, I think, is about 15% contained right now, but it's been over a week. So the progress is very slow.
So I don't know that much, and I apologize about California, other than having been there a couple of times. Is this something that's in the back of your mind? Is it something that could threaten your home or not?
We're not in a high fire risk area because we don't have a ton of vegetation around us. But I used to live very close to actually the, I just moved actually a few years ago away from essentially the epicenter of the fire. I probably would be in the next zone to be evacuated right now. So I was living in West Los Angeles. And so essentially Santa Monica and West Los Angeles, parts of it have been affected, but it's more the northern parts. I was living in the more southern part. So I would be maybe like a mile and a half away from what, where things are going on right now if I hadn't moved.
How important is it when you go through anything to talk to somebody about it? Because I think sometimes, I don't know if it's men more than women, you know, we want to be the and I'm dating myself here with the Gary Cooper, the strong, and I like old movies, the strong, silent type. Don't talk about anything. Uh-huh. Just stuff it way down there and just deal with it. And you say to yourself, nobody cares. Everybody's got problems. But how important is it from your own mental health standpoint? I'm talking about the generic you here, that people talk to others about their issues.
I think it is important. And as you mentioned, there are certain, maybe like the gender cultural norm, as well as certain other cultural norms, like in Asian culture, that's kind of how you're taught to deal with it too, for the most part, at least in mainstream Asian culture. It's like, just stuff it in and don't say anything. But I do think that there's value in processing it with a few people or even just one person. And everybody's pace of that processing is different, right? So there are people who want to talk about it for 30 minutes, an hour. And then there are some other people who maybe they just need to acknowledge that it's happening, you know, get some validation that they're not alone in how they're feeling, and then they can move on. But I think that it's very important that you express it in some way, even if it's a brief way to somebody, because when you try to ignore it, when you try to stuff it down, it's going to come out in other ways. And what I've seen most commonly is that it comes out in a physical way. People all of a sudden are saying they're having headaches, they get shingles, you know, they have GI problems, because your mind and your body are connected. And when you stuff something down and don't acknowledge it, your body essentially puts itself in a state of fight or flight, because it's like, well, something's going on, it's not being acknowledged, but I need to have my antenna up. And so it's actually really unhealthy for you, both from a physical and psychological standpoint, to not process it at all.
When it comes to the post-traumatic stress part of it, the delay, I guess, and I guess it goes to stages of grief, because I was thinking about that. Is it related to the denial and anger, acceptance and everything else? That can apply to any type of loss, right? Because we associate maybe sometimes grief with the loss of a loved one or death, but all of those stages, first of all, have those been proven to be clinically accurate? And secondly, can that apply to any type of loss, whether it's a pet, whether it's a loved one, whether it's a job or anything along those lines? Or maybe a bad health diagnosis?
Definitely, yeah. So I would say that with more research into the Kubler-Ross model, people have found that it's not necessarily linear, but that these stages are universal, in that most people experience at least a portion of them at varying times when they experience grief and loss. So you may not do it in that order that she first proposed, but that these are the common and most universal responses to any kind of grief and loss. And yes, it doesn't have to be the loss of a person. It could be the loss of your identity, the loss of a community, the loss of a stage in life, like when you were working and now you're retired, the loss of a type of relationship, like you had a certain relationship with your child and now it's a different kind of relationship. And grief and loss, and I know we've talked about this before, Tommy, but just any form of grief and loss is universal also to the human experience, right? Not every human experiences every single event or situation, but grief and loss is like something that every single human being will experience if you lived long enough, and multiple times in most cases.
Interesting point about the difference in the nature of a relationship between a parent and a child as they go through life stages, getting married, etc. We'll pick it up. We come back with Dr. Judy Ho, our good friend, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. We'll talk about keeping New Year's resolutions. We've passed quit day, I think it is, when most people give up their New Year's resolutions, but it's not all or nothing at all. There are stages of this. We'll talk about it when we come back, 938, 22 till 10. Any questions, comments, Oakland Heart Jeweler Talk and text lines open at 504-260-1870. Traffic now on WWL. 943, 17 till 10. Tommy Tucker, WWL. Tuesday morning, we like to talk about mental health occasionally every other week. And we do that with Dr. Judy Ho, our friend, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. Dr. Judy, let's talk about New Year's resolutions and making changes to your life, hopefully for the better. I know Dry January is something that's going around. I'd not heard about this, but apparently people quit drinking for a month. You know about this?
Oh, yeah. I've had some friends do that. And I think it makes them feel really accomplished. Like, hey, I can do this, and it makes me feel healthy. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody sets different kinds of New Year resolutions. I have not heard that there was an official quit day. What day is that?
Crucial quit resolution day happened last week. I forgot exactly what day it was, but it was a day where most people give up, at least not, I don't think it was something that you celebrate as much, and maybe I phrased that poorly, as much as just the day that, second Friday of January, January when, Tim? January 10th, when most people give up on their New Year's resolutions.
How interesting.
How do you...
Yeah, it makes sense.
Tell me why it makes sense.
Well, because people are so full of energy the first day of the year, like, oh my gosh, everything's going to change. And what happens is, of course, probably 10 days in, they've had, you know, one little setback, as everybody does. And then, like you were saying right before the break, people treat it as an all or none. They're like, well, forget it. If I couldn't do it on New Year's Day and I've already, you know, made a mistake so early, I should just give up. And a lot of people do give up by mid-January. But I think it's important to, one, not put so much pressure on yourself, and also, two, set your expectations that you're going to have setbacks. Like, if you go into this thinking you're going to have setbacks on your way to reaching your goal, then you're not going to be so surprised or upset with yourself or sort of be so black and white about it when an inevitable setback occurs, because it does for everyone. And also, one thing that I try to remind people of is that it takes about 4 to 6 weeks to make a new habit feel like the norm. So in the beginning, for the first month to month and a half, it's going to feel a bit treacherous. It's going to feel hard. And that is also normal. So I think sometimes people give up because they're like, well, I've been trying to do this for a couple weeks and it still feels like it's really hard. And that is completely normal from a brain science standpoint. Like, it just takes time for your brain to establish a new habit, and you have to give it a little bit of patience before you completely throw in the towel. Also, I think it's important to revise your goal. Like, if something isn't working for you, don't throw out the entire theme, but maybe think about, well, maybe I just aimed a little too high too quickly. So what is like a medium level goal that I can just focus on for the next couple of months? And then we can kind of reassess and see if I want to put the original goal back on the table after that.
And we set an artificial deadline. Like, you know, I can remember having gone through this as a younger person where it's like, well, that's it. Well, it's only January 10th. You still got a lot of time. You don't have to wait until next New Year's to try to do something different. Is it better from a behavioral standpoint? Somebody was talking, when was it? The other day about running a marathon. 2 weeks ago, I had a conversation with somebody. And they weren't a runner. And I said, well, I'll tell you, and I've never run a marathon, but what helped me get up to like 10 miles was, well, first of all, I've got replacement knees, so I would suggest you don't do that. I would suggest you go with the elliptical machine. But not to digress, but I started by running one house, and then the next day two houses, and then three houses and four houses. And it was amazing how quickly you could build up distance. Is it the same when it comes to modifying your behavior? Do you start with one day and then try to go to 2 days?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that that's a great example of how modifying your behaviors can really lead to success, as well as feelings of accomplishment along the way. Doesn't mean that you don't have your big goal that you visualize, like, okay, well, here's what I would like to do maybe in a few months or a year from now. But on a day-to-day basis, or on a week-to-week basis, it should be essentially steps on a ladder, right? To get to the top of the ladder, you have to have those smaller steps in between planned out. And also celebrate each step of that ladder. You know, sometimes people will say, well, I'll celebrate when I get to the top. But, you know, we as human beings were built to respond to more frequent positive reinforcement, not like waiting a whole year to get reinforcement. So reward yourself along the way. It doesn't have to be monetary. It could just be an acknowledgement of, hey, I did this. You know, one person that you trust, you know, sharing your progress along the way with them and having them celebrate you, you know, or just giving yourself a little treat here and there, like, okay, well, you know, I've done this for a month. I've stuck to these small goals along the way. Like, I'm going to treat myself to, you know, something. I'm going to buy myself something, small. It doesn't have to be expensive, but, you know, just to commemorate this. It is important that you earmark your achievements along the way. Otherwise, you do lose steam. You do lose motivation. And you also lose sense of exactly where you are. It's like, if you're not celebrating it, then you're also not reassessing and thinking about, well, what's working and what isn't. And assessing along the way and making improvements and adjustments is a huge part of that success.
Somebody texted in, and this is a kind of serious text about trying to quit drinking and having a hard time doing it. And how do you know when you have a drinking problem?
Yeah, good question. I think that when you know you have a problem, I think it's a couple of things. You know, some signs to watch out for is you can't stop thinking about drinking, and you try to cut down, but you're unsuccessful, and it's affecting major areas of your life, like how you function on a day-to-day basis, your emotional health, your physical health, or your relationships. If one or more of those things are happening, then I think it is time to think about cutting down on drinking, if not just stopping completely for a little while. And I think it's important to, well, first of all, if it feels really hard, consult a professional. But if you want to try it on your own, it's important to really remember why you're doing this. You know, what's the value of reducing or quitting drinking? And it's important to assess that, because otherwise the goal is going to feel empty. And then when things get hard, you'll just go right back to the drinking. For most people, drinking becomes just a habit. Like, it's just something that they start doing. But for other people, it's because it's a coping strategy. It's like a way that they escape something that they need to deal with. And so if that's the case, you need to learn other coping strategies to help you to deal with emotional stress, physical stress, anything that's going on in your life. Don't rely on alcohol, because, of course, the next day the problems are there, plus the problems that were caused by you drinking too much alcohol. So a big step is really just assessing why you're doing this and why it's important. And then I think from there, it's just about substituting in something else that might be healthier.
Let me wrap it up with this. Somebody wants to go back to post-traumatic stress syndrome, because we addressed it earlier, but they said they're watching the fires in L.A. here in New Orleans, and it's given them some Katrina PTSD, because it's a joyous place that's kind of turning into hell. And you have you have kind of experience with both, right, Dr. Judy?
Yeah. So it can be really tough. I think that natural disasters, I mean, they definitely can trigger, even if it's a different kind of natural disaster, right? Just like kind of the wake of it and how apocalyptic everything looks. I would say to this listener that it might be helpful to step away from the news a bit. I mean, it's like it almost feels like a train wreck you can't turn away from. But I think it is important in terms of protecting your mental health to step away from the news or just only, you know, set a timer essentially like, okay, 30 minutes of news and I got to turn it off and do something else, because otherwise it really does color your thoughts and how you feel. And I know that from experience from both this natural disaster as well as, you know, as you mentioned, being a peripheral experience of Katrina.
Dr. Judy, thank you as always. We appreciate your insight and your advice, and we'll talk to you again soon, okay? Tell Luca hi for us.
We will. Thanks so much.
You
take
bet.
Good care, and I'll talk to you soon.
You too.
Bye.
Stay safe. Dr. Judy Ho, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. We'll take a break. We come back. We'll find out what Newell Norman's got planned for us today here on WWL.